Good morning. The Judiciary Committee is called to order. A quorum is present, I'm pretty sure. At least if it's not, the chair recognizes the quorum. Today we have a brief budget presentation from the Uniform Laws Commission. And then we have four bills on the agenda. If we do not finish today, members, and I'll note this, if we do not finish, we will continue it tomorrow during regular committee time. And if we can't finish within tomorrow's regular committee time, we have a room booked on Thursday evening at 5 p.m. in room 200. So, and I note that because I think in several other committees, even though we were 4 weeks out from deadlines, we're having routine evening meetings. So in the interest of being efficient and saving your time, we have not yet had an evening meeting this year, even though I think a lot of committees have had that, and I'm kind of proud of that. So I'd like to continue this streak as long as we can. The first bill up will be, after we go through the Uniform Laws Commission, will be Representative Schultz. The plan is to amend this bill and recommend it be re-referred to GovOps. The testimony should be limited to our jurisdiction. This is the second hearing. There will be two more stops. Then I've got three bills up, which I won't go into because we'll leave that for the hearing time. So first item is approval of minutes from February 26th. Do I have a motion to approve?
So moved.
Chair Scott moves the minutes from February 26th. Any discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. The minutes of February 26th are approved. Uniform Laws Commission, Uniform Law Commission presentation. Come on up. Welcome, Ms. Timmons. Please identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm Michelle Timmons. I'm with the Uniform Law Commission and a former reviser of statutes for our state. I am going to give you a very brief budget testimony today so you can get into your bills. The budget request for the Uniform Law Commission is $98,000 per year or $196,000 over the biennium. This request is right at the governor's recommendation. Bob Tennyson put the budget together with Jim King from MMB. And the purpose of the budget is to allow the same level of service by the volunteer Uniform Law Commissioners as we discussed last time we were in front of you. So the budget is very simple. It covers only two cost centers. One cost center is the annual dues for the organization. The current dues are $60,600 per year, and those are projected to increase slightly with inflation. The remainder of the appropriation is used to reimburse the travel costs for the Minnesota commissioners to attend the annual meeting. And the annual meeting is required. It's really more like a mini legislative session. And so there is reimbursement at the level of state reimbursement policies. The increase in the budget is $5,000 per year. And that increase simply covers the projected increase in the two cost centers. So that about sums up the Uniform Law Commission budget. And with that, if there are any questions.
It's the best presentation I've heard so far. Are there questions from members? Ms. Timmons, how are the dues for each state calculated on what we pay, 60 grand a year? I'm assuming California pays more.
Mr. Chairman, yes. The dues are calculated based on state population, so California pays substantially more than Minnesota.
Okay. All righty. And then any other questions for members? I'm not going to ask if you guys fly business class, coach, or first class, but I assume I know the answer. Well, if that's it, there are no other questions. That was quick and dirty. I appreciate it. You were clearly very effective in your testimony, Ms. Timmons. And we also have Kim Lowe and Robert Tennyson on the list, but are they're not going to testify.
Mr. Chairman, I got an email from Kim Lowe this morning that she's ill, and I believe Bob Tennyson had a conflict. So I'm it today.
Excellent. Well, you're enough, Ms. Timmons. Thank you very much. It's great to have you back in the committee. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, members, with that, obviously with those items, we'll go through that as we get closer to the finance deadlines. But the first bill up is House File 90. That is Representative Schultz. Please come forward. We're ahead of schedule by about 11 minutes, so hopefully we don't burn through that. But we have the first bill up for is House File 90. I'll move that Representative Schultz's bill be recommended be re-referred to the Government Operations Committee, and there are amendments you would like to offer. Is that right?
I would like to have Representative Liebling offer the A5 and A9 amendment. If
Representative Liebling offers the A5. We'll take them one at a time. Go ahead. Did you have any comments on the A5?
Yes, I have a testifier that can speak to the A5 amendment.
Sure,
Mr. Ron Elwood.
Go ahead, Mr. Elwood. And it's your birthday today, Mr. Elwood, right?
Mr. Chair, members, it is.
Oh, that's happy birthday.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Despite what I told you earlier, we do not sing happy birthday in this committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We'll wait till after the adjournments, maybe we do. Okay, go ahead on the A5. Happy birthday.
Thanks again. Mr. Chair and members, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. In all my remarks today, I'll be speaking for a coalition of consumer advocates, which includes Legal Aid, AARP, and Elder Voice Family Advocates. So the A5 amendment is highly technical. It was it's repealing a repealer because the repealed section is actually amended in the bill, so that was a mistake. So it's simply correcting a mistake by repealing the repealer.
Okay. Well, are there any questions on repealing a repealer? Seeing none, then all in favor of the A5 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Motion passes. Okay, and you've got an A9 also, is that right?
I do have an A9, Chair.
What's the A9 do?
Go ahead, Ron.
And, Mr. Chair, I would move the A9 amendment.
Okay. Chair Liebling moves the A9. Go ahead, Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair and members, the A9 provides some clarification to one of the sections of the bill. In the bill, there is a section that would prohibit retaliation for certain acts of a resident or family, for example, filing a maltreatment report or filing a complaint. One of the presumptions, the rebuttable presumption of retaliation, is if an eviction or service termination is filed within 90 days of such an act. What we subsequently realized was that in another section where we provide termination and discharge protections, there are legitimate reasons for someone to be discharged or their service terminated. For example, if they violated the lease or that's the ability of the establishment to no longer care for the person. So we have those sections. Without this amendment, those two would be in conflict because if there was a legitimate reason to discharge or terminate service under the discharge section, but on the other section it would be presumed retaliation, that is not the intent of this bill or any of us here. So what this amendment does is clarify that if there is a legitimate reason under the service termination section to discharge or terminate services, that does not constitute retaliation. So we wanted to make that clear.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions about that? All in favor of the A9 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Okay. And then there's a third amendment. Is that right, Mr. Elwood?
We're going to present the bill first.
Oh, got it. Okay, sure. Go ahead. Let's do that.
Members, Mr. Chair, the bill before you, House File 90, is a result because of all the various stories we've heard from families this last year about widespread and often horrific and unthinkable abuse of older and vulnerable adults living in assisted living establishments and nursing homes. This bill tries to address the elder abuse that we've seen in the state. This bill will seek to address those problems in a systematic and multifaceted way. So for today's hearing, I just want to focus on the sections of the bill that are specific to this committee, Judiciary. So first, in Article 1, Section 2, we set forth content and disclosure requirements for assisted living contracts. I'd like to highlight one provision starting on line 5.16 that would require the assisted living establishment to ask the prospective resident to designate a representative. This provision is intended to clarify for all concerned who may speak for the resident, because not infrequently we have heard that providers get caught in the middle when more than one family member purports to represent the resident and they have differing opinions. This provision is intended to avoid that difficult situation. The second, beginning on line 14.27 of the bill, sets forth extensive rules for the road for the placement of a camera or other electronic monitoring device in the resident's room to detect and deter abuse. The bill requires consent of the resident and any roommate and requires notification to the facility with a 30-day exception if the resident reasonably fears retaliation. Third, starting on line 23.8, the bill contains prohibitions of deceptive marketing. This is one of the most common complaints we have heard from older and vulnerable adults and their families, that assisted living establishments promise that they will take care of the resident throughout their aging process, but as soon as their condition changes, they are told they can no longer care for the resident and give them a termination notice. The fourth, beginning on line 24.25 of the bill, provides protections against involuntary discharges and service terminations. Of particular interest for this committee is section beginning on line 27.27 that gives residents in assisted living, like residents in nursing homes now have, the right to appeal a discharge or service termination to the Office of Administrative Hearings. This section requires the bill to go to the government operations, where we are asking the bill to be referred to next. The bill also provides for a private right of action to enforce the most critical of the Bill of Rights. I want to note that the advocates have made significant concessions in this section since last year. Last year's bill provided for enforcement of all the rights. This year's bill narrows that dramatically and only allows private enforcement of the most important ones, such as freedom from maltreatment and retaliation, denial of visitors and legal counsel, and violations of deceptive marketing. Finally, on line 29.12, the bill provides protections against oppressive forced arbitration clauses. This bill does not ban them. We are preempted from doing that. Rather, the bill requires disclosure, prohibits these clauses from requiring the resident to go to Virginia or some other state if there's a lawsuit by either side, and prohibits the contract from being subject to Mississippi law or the law of any other state than Minnesota. It also requires that the clause not be unconscionable, or in other words, so one-sided as to be patently unfair. So I want to thank the chair and members of the committee, and I urge your support, and we're open for questions.
Okay, thank you. Questions from members? Well, there are no questions yet. We've got testifiers coming down, right? We got testifiers in favor. When do we do? Are we going to do those first? Why don't we do those first, right? Or did you want to do questions first?
We can do testifiers first. Is there many questions for the testifiers?
Because they'll probably answer some of the questions anyway. So, nothing else from you, Mr. Elwood. Ms. Moline? Let me ask this. Are there folks here in opposition? Raise your hand if you come down here and testify in opposition. Raise your hand, please. Okay, there's one. One person. Wait, two. There we go. Two people. Okay, go ahead, Ms. Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Carly Moline, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Attorney General's Office. Attorney General Keith Ellison is in strong support of House File 90 and the efforts of advocates, the public, and legislators to take care of our seniors and protect them from fraud and abuse. The A7 amendment that's in front of the committee for consideration makes a violation of the new proposed law an unlawful practice that can be enforced by the Attorney General's office as a fraudulent misrepresentation or deceptive practice, more commonly known as the Consumer Fraud Act. This is a section that our attorneys are very familiar with, and the remedies provided allow for the Attorney General's office to seek a civil action, including injunctive relief, in which we would seek redress from the court ordering the assisted living facility to halt such actions. Our office does receive a number of complaints on elder abuse issues. After the Star Tribune reports on elder abuse, complaints to our office increased significantly. There wasn't previously a tracking system where we tracked how many and what type of complaints the AG's office has received. But since Attorney General Ellison has taken office, he has directed our Consumer Services Division to start tracking these complaints so we have more accurate numbers. I can tell you anecdotally that our attorneys have said elder abuse complaints have increased significantly, and they've had to assign additional attorneys to this task specifically. The bill before you, if it's amended by the A7 amendment, will allow our office to provide a more meaningful remedy for families and consumers who have suffered harm as a result of inadequate care. When Minnesota consumers, including those expecting to receive a certain level of care and services, don't receive that care as a result of fraud, deceit, or misrepresentation, their rights and interests should be protected. The Minnesota Attorney General's office wants to be part of protecting those Minnesotans. Thank you, Representative Schultz, for carrying this bill, and thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for hearing my testimony.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Lalina. It's great to have you back here in Room 10. You used to sit right over there, I know.
I did, Mr. Chair.
Like when they called this committee the firing squad, so... welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And the firing squad. Okay, why don't we start with Mr. Pearson? Going to come down this way? Oh, okay. Well, based upon those comments from Ms. Moline, I am going to offer the A7 amendment. So that's up. Are there any discussion? I move the A7 amendment. And... I know I made you guys come up here right now, but we may have questions from Mr. Elwood. Any questions from members about the A7 amendment? Okay, seeing none, then all in favor of the A7 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Motion passes. Okay, the bill has been amended with the A7 on it. Go ahead, Mr. Pearson or Ms. Thurlow, whichever you want to.
Mr. Chair, if I may, my name is Carrie Thurlow. I'm with Leading Age Minnesota here on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. In the interest of time, we sort of tag-team this, if that's okay.
Great. We always love the interest of time here. Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I want to clarify that we raised our hand saying we're here in opposition. I think it's more fair to say that we're here raising concerns about the bill. So to offer a few kind of framing remarks, and then I'll turn it over to my colleague, Mr. Pearson. To start, the stories that we have heard of harm and abuse in the news and as we've met with and talked with consumers are terrible. They are intolerable. And we want to thank Commissioner Malcolm and the Department of Health for bringing all the stakeholders together over the interim to discuss the important issues raised by these stories in an attempt to address workable solutions that can move forward in this legislative session. The Long-Term Care Imperative fully participated in these discussions, and we found, as we long suspected, that we have significant common ground with consumers and regulators alike. So please be clear that as we raise concerns and questions about the bill, that we remain committed to working with all stakeholders as this moves through the process. The work groups in the interim identified several shared values and principles that should guide our important work on this bill. The first is that it is important to maintain choice and flexibility in assisted living. Minnesota has been nationally recognized for promoting choice and flexibility, and it's important to remember that assisted living establishments are not institutions. They are home and community-based services, and we are not looking to create more nursing homes. Secondly, seniors should be able to live as independently as possible for as long as they are able to access safe quality care in their communities that they call home. The third guiding value is that there are many perspectives in this work that need to be considered as we work together to ensure that we have a system that balances the values of independence and choice with the desire for safety and protection. Fourth, whatever laws we pass in this session, we need to ensure there are adequate resources for implementation and enforcement. This has been a key issue that we have discussed throughout the work groups, and that new regulations must have clear enforcement mechanisms, which is an issue that we've identified as we've discussed. And then finally, last but not least, prevention should be a key focus of this work. I know we're talking about a lot of regulations and tools to respond to abuse, and that is certainly important. But we should ensure that there is an infrastructure in place to use data collected to help inform prevention efforts so that abuse is prevented at the front end and not just simply looking at responses. To be clear, the long-term care imperative supports assisted living licensure with specific criteria for evaluation, disclosure, and service termination. We support increased dementia care standards. We support electronic monitoring legislation. And we support strengthened protections for consumers against retaliation and deceptive marketing. And as we consider and discuss through our concerns with some of the items in this bill, we look forward to continued work with stakeholders to find solutions that more closely reflect the emerging consensus and shared values on these issues. In closing of my comments, I want to thank Representative Schultz as well as Representative Liz Olson, who have really truly been leaders on these issues. We look forward to continued discussion on these issues throughout this legislative session.
Thank you, Ms. Thurlow, for your comments. Mr. Pearson?
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Toby Pearson, Care Providers of Minnesota, today with the Long-Term Care Imperative as well. As we have said, we support moving ahead with an assisted living license. However, the details do matter, and that's where I get to play bad cop and tell you all the details we have concerns about. There are many provisions brought forth by this bill which we support and which were discussed in the interim work group meetings. However, for those provisions that we find operationally challenging, we are hopeful that there can be a resolution during the legislative process. We have a responsibility to identify the potential for unintended consequences of this proposal, provisions where businesses could lose, could close, where they cannot meet the standards, or where their financing arrangements are at risk. Provisions where the results will be consumers experiencing no access to services that they want, and provisions that are simply impossible to meet with a workforce shortage. First concern is that the providers must take all payer sources. The language incorrectly assumes that all providers are enrolled and eligible to accept all payment sources, including publicly funded programs such as Medicaid, as well as private insurance. It also does not consider whether the payment offered will be sufficient to cover the needed level of services. The Supreme Court held in a case in 1984 that Medicaid is in fact a voluntary program, and if you're making everybody take all payer sources, you're forcing enrollment in Medicaid. Second, there's a lengthy, complicated appeals process for service terminations. The biggest concern is that there's no time frame for hearing resolution and that assisted living must still take care of the folks who are residents. The assisted living establishment bears the burden of proof to establish the termination of housing or services is permissible, and potentially it delays resolution of situations that are simply unsafe. There's a big question of who will care for a resident that has initiated this process if a provider has said that they can no longer care for that resident. There's also concern that the new process is in addition to current landlord-tenant law. There needs to be one single process for reconsideration. Potentially under this language, a resident could pursue an appeal with the OAH, and then if they do not prevail in that process, they could go and file another claim in housing court, thus having two bites at the apple. We agree in concept with some form of appeal in the new licensure arena. This language has too many problems. Third, overly broad definition of deceptive marketing and retaliation. Providers are not opposed to greater protections for either of these issues, but the language appears to be overly broad. For example, with respect to deceptive marketing, It would apply to any misleading statement or representation by any employee. Recollections of verbal interactions are not reliable, which is why typically we rely on written contracts and contract law. Additionally, there are numerous existing state laws for consumer protection from deceptive marketing, including laws prohibiting false advertising and deceptive trade practices. With respect to retaliation, the language would apply to acts against a resident, employee, or any person with familial, personal, legal, or professional relationship with the patient or the resident. We think this is an overly broad universe of people. Under the language, the provider is presumed guilty of retaliation for a long list of actions taken within 90 days of an initial complaint. This could include an increase in necessary services if the resident's condition changed, the discharge of a resident if their care needs exceeded the provider's ability to administer said care, and would even potentially prevent the termination or discipline of an employee who self-reported a maltreatment incident. While we appreciate the amendment that was previously adopted, we still have concerns with the retaliation language. We also believe that this language will invite more lawsuits when no quantifiable damages occur. Currently, plaintiffs who have suffered actual personal damages have the right to sue and exercise that right. Under this language, there's an increase up to $3,000 whether you had suffered a loss or not. Another concern is within the electronic monitoring. Much of the language is agreed upon with the exception of the notice of monitoring, whether the facility should receive notice of the placement of an electronic monitoring device or not. We believe that the provider should be notified of electronic monitoring devices to help carry out their duty to protect the privacy and the dignity of the residents. We appreciate that there may be a limited time frame for a workaround process, but currently we still believe that the notice should go to the provider. We pledge our support to continue meeting with the authors and the advocates to work towards consensus on as many of these issues as possible. It's our hope that this process will allow for an open dialogue and resolution of the different perspectives through negotiations, and that there will be a final legislation on older adult protections that can be signed into law this year. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. F., for your comments, Mr. Pearson. Any comments or questions from members of the committee? Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I noticed that you had some issues with some of the language, and I do too, and you kind of addressed a couple things that were a little bit more broad, and I would just wonder if you could kind of drill down into what your solutions might be on a couple of things. For one, the retaliation issue, what you're saying is you think current law is adequate to address harm, or is there any private right of action in this bill that you see as appropriate?
Mr. Pearson. And Ms. Thurlow.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'll start, and then Mr. Pearson may have more to add. The retaliation language in the bill, one of the most challenging aspects of the retaliation language is the presumption, the rebuttable presumption that is created, and the 90-day with a 90-day window after filing a complaint. In our view, it presumes, in that scenario, it presumes that a provider is acting, committing a retaliatory act if any complaint is filed sort of within that 90 days. And as Mr. Pearson discussed, there are a lot of scenarios that fall under that. Not only sort of evolving service plan needs for the client that would be presumed retaliatory under the language, notwithstanding the amendment that the committee already adopted, but even if an employee self-reports a incident of maltreatment, if action is taken, discipline or termination or any retraining under that, it could be presumed retaliatory. And then the burden of proof is on the provider to prove that they did not. We think that that standard is particularly problematic in this bill and is something that we're looking at.
As I said in my opening comments, we are open to looking at strengthening retaliation language. We certainly do not endorse retaliation, and we have heard consumers that this is a concern, but we think the language here goes too far.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so what you're saying is under this current language, you think that it lacks due process in a way?
Ms. Thurlow.
Mr. Chair, Representative, somewhat. I think the issue is the rebuttable presumption within the 90 days of action. I think we need to tighten that up somewhat to make that less of a burden or sort of a, could have a chilling effect for a provider to take appropriate responses and actions as care needs evolve or as situations evolve. So that's really our main concern.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so what would be your suggestion for how to change that?
Ms. Thurlow.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we continue to meet almost weekly with the stakeholders, so I'm not going to sit at the testifier stand and offer a solution here. We remain committed to working this issue out. We've shared this concern and hope that we can come to an accommodation, but I think it will be around tightening up that 90-day rebuttable presumption.
And note, Ms. Thurlow, that the chair appreciates your nuanced ability to work in this venue, too. I mean, sooner or later, sometimes we might have to come an amendment and vet it publicly, but that's a good way to do things. I would note that I think that's the 90-day rebuttable presumption, and correct me if I'm wrong with a north-south or east-west, but that exists for current tenants in Minnesota law, right? Isn't it, Mr. Elwood, a rebuttable presumption if action is taken after a tenant, for example, files like a rent escrow or something like that? It rebuttably presumes. Is that a north-south? I'm assuming that's why the law is this way.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'd have to go back and look at 504B to be sure that is correct. I'm not 100% sure. I do know that rebuttable presumptions are prevalent throughout Minnesota statutes in a whole variety of areas. And not only that, but several states in this specific arena of retaliation in assisted living have the very same provision, and this, apparently the sky hasn't fallen. And I'd also suggest to you that it's a rebuttable presumption, again, so that does provide adequate due process for everyone concerned.
Okay. Thank you for your answer to that. I didn't mean to put you on the spot to go look up 504, but as I recall, in dealing with rent escrows tenants had problems with landlords, that if you availed yourself of your legal due process rights under law and you filed a rent escrow or took an action, that there was a rebuttable presumption. If the landlord then said, oh yeah, you're going to do that, kick you out, the landlord has to show, oh, by the way, yeah, it's because they flooded the apartment with pot smoke or something. I don't know. I mean, you know, it's still there. You can still show it. But I guess I had thought that was the reason why it was put in there in the first place. Now, it's different, you know, with these types of facilities. There's I guess, a different sensitivity, like when Happy Gilmore puts his grandma in the place, and then Ben Stiller's the mean guy that makes him knit potholders or something. Everyone's paranoid about that, right? So we got to protect grandma. I'm sorry, but this was your line of questioning, Chair Scott. Go ahead.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Love the Happy Gilmore analogy there.
Happy Gilmore.
One of the questions I had was regarding having an administrator for each of these assisted living facilities. And is the language saying that each location has to have an administrator, or if one entity owns several, there's just one administrator requirement? And are you folks okay with the language regarding an administrator for each?
Mr. Pearson?
Mr. Chair, members, I think what we've discussed in the group is that there's been an expressed concern from advocates that they don't know who's in charge. So what we're trying to figure out with them in our conversations is how do you do you use the term administrator first in an assisted living setting? And then secondly, does that apply to corporate entities and how they manage different facilities at different locations? So we are not opposed to determining, like, who's in charge. I think we have to finesse exactly how that works in multiple locations, making sure that we're sensitive to the advocate's needs to know who's in charge, but at the same time making sure we have enough flexibility in corporate relationships to allow for us to have different venues out there. If I could, Mr. Chair, to go back to the previous questioning, not the Happy Gilmore reference, which I appreciate, and not the pot smoking, because most of the time that's not the problem in assisted living. But one of the things I did want to mention that probably was pertinent to the conversation was in the retaliation language, there's not a provision that says that the report must be made in good faith. And that's one of the concerns we have about the language, is that people can in bad faith take action or make allegations, and at the same time, that creates the rebuttable presumption. So there needs to be a balancing between how you use that rebuttable presumption. As you point out, it does exist in landlord-tenant law. How do we incorporate that into this, and at the same time import the necessity from the reporter that there be a good faith component to their report?
Okay. Thank you for that answer. Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question about the private right of action for something like denial of visitors. And maybe this is more appropriate question for the bill author, but I'm just trying to figure out in my brain what that would look like if you're denying someone a visitor, how there's a private right of action would be something that would be an appropriate fix for that. Well, making the person whole.
Who do you want to answer that, Chair Scott?
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Elwood. Okay, come on, Mr. Elwood. You're on again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Scott. I think you've raised exactly the reason why this is critically important to have a private right, because under current law, we have a significant number of rights under the Home Care Bill of Rights and a significant number of rights under the Health Care Bill of Rights that apply to assisted living residents and nursing home residents, respectively. They're powerful. It's powerful language, but it's pretty meaningless because they're just nice words on paper. Because if there's violations, there's absolutely nothing that an individual can do to enforce those rights. So if, for example, a visitor was denied entry, your daughter or son or whatever, and there's really nothing anybody could do about that. With this, you could actually take an action and require the facility to actually grant the rights that they are, that the resident is granted under law. So I think that's exactly why this is needed.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll reserve the remaining questions.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Oh, here we go. Chair Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just quickly, and, you know, this obviously this is going through a lot of committees, so a lot of these, I know members are really interested in this topic. Not huge amounts of the bill actually relate to this committee, but I just want to make a quick comment about the retaliation thing and just remind people that there's a real imbalance of power going on here between people who live in these facilities and the people who own them. And it is somewhat parallel to landlord-tenant because this is where you live, and you've got vulnerable people for whom moving is a big deal. And that's the issue. And when we've heard these stories in other committees about people being kicked out, you know, if your family member, your elderly mother who's very frail is suddenly told she's got to leave, all of a sudden, oh, my gosh, where is she going to go? And what are we going to do? So, you know, I think it's entirely appropriate, the part about the rebuttable presumption, because there is a great power imbalance here, and we're talking about somebody's living conditions and what are they going to do if they're suddenly retaliated against. So I just want to make that comment, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Liebling. Any other comments or questions for members? We are over time on what we've allotted for this, but I'll entertain any other questions if you have them.
Okay. Any other members of the audience that wish to be heard on this House file as amended, House File 90? Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman and members, Joel Carlson of the Minnesota Association for Justice. I just appreciate all the hard work that the advocates have gone through to put this bill together. I just have one point that I'd like the committee to look at, and it is on page 73. And, Mr. Chairman and members, as a facility may go into receivership, the commissioner may appoint a manager, and in lines 73.13 through 73.20, it deals with their liability to the residents. And it looks on its face like the only claim that they may have is for an injury to a person based on the condition of the assisted living facility, and I'm not sure that that is the intent. And as to their fiduciary duty, they're not personally responsible unless they're grossly negligent or intentional, and I think that that is a pretty high standard for someone who has a fiduciary duty. So I only point those two out, and I'm happy to talk with the author because I'm not sure that that's what the intent is. It wasn't discussed in the overview.
Thank you. Mr. Carlson, under current theories of tort liability, either statutory or common law, I think I hear what you're saying. We're substantially increasing the burden that an aggrieved party must present. Is that accurate to say?
Mr. Chairman and members, yes. Gross negligence, and first of all, there's no insurance coverage for intentional acts. Gross negligence is generally no care at all. You didn't exercise any care with regard to your duty to the people in the facility, and I'm not certain that's the intent, and I only point that out so that as it goes forward, we can make sure that's clear.
That is duly noted, and I hope that we can get that addressed going forward. Thank you, Mr. Carlson.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Did I already ask for anyone from the audience? Come. Anyone else from the audience? Okay. Seeing none, then thank you. Any discussions from the committee other than questions? Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question for the bill author.
Okay. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Schultz, one of the issues that I had with this is that you're requiring these assisted living facilities to really not have any choice on whether they take certain payment types. So an assisted living facility, for instance, would have to take, rather than just choosing if they wanted to, just only take people that that were private pay, that they would be forced to take people on Medicaid. And I'm just wondering why that provision is in there.
I'll
let Ron answer.
Go ahead, Mr.
Elwood. Mr. Elwood answer that first, and then I'll respond.
Mr. Chair and Representative Scott, this is a provision that is prevalent in many other states, and I think it's a bit mischaracterized because if you read the language, the title of the section is No Discrimination Based on the Source of Payment. That language is in, I believe, 10 states. And so the idea is that, you know, we've had this discussion in this context for many, many, many years, because once the person is in there for years, spending, you know, $7,000, $8,000, $9,000, $10,000 a month, spends down all their money and now goes on elderly waiver, they are treated differently because they are now on public pay. And many states have found that to be unacceptable. And folks should be treated equally regardless of whether their source of payment is the private money, which they run through, or then public pay. So that's essentially the idea, is you can't discriminate against the resident based on the source of payment.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So once they've spent down their private, in your example, once they've spent all their private money and they go to a Medicaid situation, does the reimbursement rate to the provider go down with that?
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair and Representative Scott, likely, but they have been paying tens $10,000 a month for years and years and years and years for these services, and with the promise that they will be taken care of no matter, you know, what happens to them and to the age in place. So it seems discriminatory that once you we've heard stories, for example, where you get the piece of cake for dessert, the fancy piece of cake, when you're on private pay, and then once you go on public pay, you get a half a cookie. And that just doesn't seem right.
Triska.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, well, right now we have a similar situation with any other landlord-tenant situation where, as a landlord, you are not required to take people that are on Section 8, for instance. So how is this any different? I mean, you're still, I don't know, you use the word discriminating, but you're making the choice as a private owner of that property, you know, to take or not take certain forms of payment. So how is this any, how would this situation be that much different than what's going on now? And it's not being found to be discriminatory.
Mr. Elwood.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Scott, first of all, the non-discriminatory language is a parallel to what is now in federal law for nursing homes, so I see no reason why we shouldn't be extending it to assisted living, since there are more than twice as many people living in assisted living now than there are in nursing homes. It's just going to grow. And in terms of a landlord-tenant situation, you know, it's very different. In a landlord-tenant situation, we're not providing care. And here we're providing care for very vulnerable people.
Chair Scott, and we're going to wrap this up.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your indulgence. And the one thing I don't want to do with these assisted living places is create nursing homes. We already have a separate set of statutes and regulations for that. And if this is going to just be nursing home 2.0, then why are we wasting our time on this licensure to just make whatever's required of nursing homes to be required for assisted living situations? And so that's what I want to steer away from, because, you know, a lot of these assisted living places are owned by mom and pops. They're not owned by these big corporations, so they don't have the means. So if somebody is paying $8,000 a year, and then all of a sudden that's cut to $3,000, or not $8,000 a month, and then all of a sudden, because they have to go on Medicaid, that's to goes to $3,000, and I don't know what the real numbers are. I'm just throwing that out there. That's a real burden for them financially. So I hope that I've made my point here, I guess, but that's one of the concerns I have. Thank you for answering the question.
Thank you, Chair Scott. Any other discussion from committee members? Seeing none, then who made this motion? Did I make it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And the chair renews his motion that House File 90, as amended, be re-referred to the Government Operations Committee. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no.
No.
Motion passes. Thank you very much, Representative Schultz. You're on your way. You want to chair the committee? Okay, drone bill. Excellent. In fact,
all right, members, the bill we'll be hearing next is House File 1236, regulating the use of unmanned aerial vehicles by law enforcement agencies, proposing coding for new law in Minnesota Statutes, Chapter 626. And what's that? A little gavel.
Quiet the room down, thank you.
What do you want?
Yeah.
Shh, quiet down a little bit, please.
Quiet down, all right. Move out.
All right. Chair Lesh, would you like to move your bill to get it before the committee?
I would, Madam Chair. Thank you.
All right. So Chair Lesh moves that House File 1236 be recommended to be re-referred to the Public Safety Committee. And with that, go ahead and tell us about your bill, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This bill regulates the use of unmanned aerial vehicles, UAVs or drones, by law enforcement
and most importantly, establishes a search warrant requirement for drone use unless an exception applies. This is in subdivision 2. These exceptions would be in an emergency that involves a threat to life or safety, in a public area if law enforcement obtains a court order based on reasonable suspicion of criminal activity, to counter high risk of a terrorist attack, or in situations of man-made or natural disasters. Now, if the drone is used under one of these exceptions, law enforcement just has to submit the statement to the district court within 2 days. The bill also includes several limitations, including that it has to comply with FAA requirements and guidelines. Acquisition of drones has to be approved by the governmental entity overseeing the agency. Unless authorized in the warrant, data collection must be on a clearly and narrowly defined target and must avoid other individuals' homes or areas. This is the dragnet rule. The agency may not deploy facial recognition or other biometric technology unless authorized by a court order or warrant, and it may not be equipped with weapons. The bill classifies drone footage as criminal investigative data and mandates deletion of the collected data on a person or place not subject to the warrant within 24 hours. And this subject of drone surveillance will eventually receive notice similar to the tracking warrants that we passed and are repassing. So, and there are reporting requirements on law enforcement and court administration in Subdivision 10. Members, we've tried to pass some version of this bill since 2011. And there have just been, one of the reasons that we've been unable to pass it is because there have always been really big fish to fry, like the cell phone exploitation devices, like license plate readers, like police body cams. And all of these major issues have sucked all of the oxygen out of the room and have prevented us from getting ahead of this. So now we're a good decade and a half behind our ability to see what's actually going on in the monitoring of Minnesota residents. So that's one of the reasons why we're offering this, to try to get ahead of it. And with that, I would introduce Ben Feist with the ACLU, who's supporting the legislation.
Welcome, Mr. Feist. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ben Feist. I'm legislative director with the ACLU of Minnesota. The ACLU of Minnesota strongly supports House File 1236. As Chair Lesh mentioned, this has been a work in progress for many years now. Chair Johnson had authored drone regulation bills in the past as well, and the version that we have before us today has been vetted over the years by the BCA and law enforcement to address some of the concerns. I think they may still have a few as this goes forward, but this is definitely a version that has tried to bring everyone to the table and get to a point where we can reasonably restrict drone use in Minnesota. Simply put, drone surveillance turns on its head the American principle that we don't watch innocent people just in case they do something wrong. Unregulated, warrantless drone operations have the potential to interfere with Minnesotans' reasonable expectation of privacy, chill First Amendment-protected activities, and lead to discriminatory targeting. The pace at which surveillance technology has evolved in recent years has far outstripped the pace at which our laws have adapted to protect individual privacy. As Chair Lesh mentioned, again, this is a great opportunity to catch up on this technology before it is used everywhere in Minnesota. There are certain departments that have already put drone programs in use, even though there is nothing in state statute regulating how that should work, and it would be great to get a statewide regulation in place. I think it's important to note that drones are a new and powerful technology. Unlike helicopters or other police vehicles, they're not subject to a lot of the same practical limitations that we've seen in the past. For example, helicopters tend to be very costly, require trained human pilots, launch pads, flight and ground crews. Drones, on the other hand, are cheap, and they're getting to be increasingly powerful and can be used for secret surveillance in a way that helicopters and other technologies haven't been able to. Ultimately, this bill really does balance public safety and privacy rights by requiring a search warrant for those targeted drone surveillance and allowing all the exceptions that Chair Lesh already went through today. We also very much support the public accountability mechanisms in the bill. For example, providing notice eventually the fact that you were the target of drone surveillance, because unlike a traditional search warrant where law enforcement may come to your door and present the warrant saying that we want to get information about you, the drone doesn't drop off a little piece of paper in your yard saying that you've been targeted. So we want that notice to come out after the investigation and a reasonable amount of time has passed. It's also tracking with some of the reporting requirements that we've had on cell phone location tracking, which will be good for the legislature to understand just what the situation is in Minnesota with law enforcement's use of this technology. But with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. And Mr. Feist, I had a couple of questions. The first one is, with that revealing the notice, is that just pertaining to warrants granted under Subdivision 1? That doesn't, there's nothing that has to be disclosed with regard to the exception provisions?
Madam Chair, that is correct. The with the other exceptions, there is under Subdivision 3 just a requirement that law enforcement file something with the court. So there's some level of public transparency, but under those exceptions, there usually isn't a specific target of the bill that would get notice.
Okay, great. Thank you. And then are you aware of any case law that's been addressing these drones under a Fourth Amendment analysis?
Madam Chair, not to my knowledge yet. I think those are slowly coming up through the courts. The things that I've seen so far that the technology hasn't been so pervasive as to cause a lot of trouble nationally. And it appears that most of the law enforcement agencies that are doing this are concerned that if they do it without a traditional search warrant currently, the evidence will be excluded. So I think the best practice, and we'll probably hear from law enforcement on this as well, is that generally if you are targeting someone and trying to obtain evidence, hopefully you're getting a search warrant to begin with. But since there's not that requirement under Minnesota law, we think this is a really good bill.
Okay, great. Thanks. Questions from other members? Yep, Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You said that you've been working on this for several years. Is law enforcement on board with this language?
Well, we're going to hear from them.
Chair Lesh?
Well, we're going to hear from them. So rather than have them go into it, why don't we have them say how much they hate it or not?
All right. Are there any specific questions now, or we can go ahead and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So one of the things that we've done with some of this surveillance technology in the past is we've created required audit trails and those sorts of things. Now, I see in this bill that they're only keeping the data for 24 hours, but if it was investigative data, would they be keeping it longer? And if so, then would the audit trail and role-based access and so forth become something that would be appropriate to put into this bill?
Mr. Feist?
Madam Chair and Chair Scott, I think your reading of the bill is correct, that currently it would be investigative data, and that there's, other than the reporting requirements that are in there, there is not a specific audit trail. And that would certainly be something that the ACLU would support as an addition.
Thank you. Okay. Why don't we go ahead and have those come up who have some concerns about the bill? And I believe Mr. Terry Steben is the first. Hi,
Madam Chair, members, I'm Tim Leslie, Sheriff in Dakota County, and I'll be testifying first, and then Mr. Steben will come up if that's okay.
That is just fine. Go right ahead.
So despite the fear, there is no black helicopters in Dakota County surveilling people. I've had a drone program since January of 2017. Dakota County is the third most populous county in the state. We have tremendous critical infrastructure that we care for, 11 police departments, none of which have drones. I'm the only agency of law enforcement that has drones. In my calculus to decide whether to have a drone program or not, I took into account what is located in Dakota County. We have a refinery. We're adjacent to a nuclear power plant. We have our share of weather disasters, possibly some spring flooding coming up this year. It fits within our mission. My mission is to be progressive, to care for the constituency that I represent in Dakota County. We want to be efficient as well. We want to make sure that when there's a fatal car crash and we can take photographs from with by using a drone, that we get those crash scenes cleared quickly so people can get to work or get home from work. Nothing against the state patrol, but it's much less costly than a helicopter, you know, significantly. I think a helicopter is about $600 an hour. I think we run the drone for about $20 an hour. Plus, it doesn't wake up the entire community when you're searching for a suspect in a cornfield. My constituents, again, do expect that I do things efficiently, but also balance that with the responsibility to do things with the trust relationship I've built with the county residents that I serve. We're very deliberate when we began our research for our program. We sent someone to school. We have a pilot on staff who's a private pilot, and he attended school, did the research, made recommendations on what we thought would be an appropriate purchase for the county. But I also answered the public safety question for the fathers, the mothers, the sons and daughters that we employ as law enforcement. Why would I put people in harm's way when I can use a device like a drone to take pictures inside a refinery or take pictures inside the nuclear power plant where there's some weird chemical floating around or some kind of or take a look at a tornado that just hit in the county? I would rather have a device like a drone take those photographs rather than put a human being in those circumstances. Some of the elements of our program, we never surveil people. That's not in our policy. It's in our policy that we never surveil people. So what do we do? The primary purpose in this program that we've had for the last 2 years has been crime or crash scene photography. So if you have a serious event with a police officer involved shooting, maybe a murder scene or a fatal car crash, you bring the drone out to capture that scene. And then the judiciary, the bench in Dakota County, has come to expect it. They want to see that view of the scene, the overall scene, where everything was laid out. It's a wonderful way to illustrate what we faced when we got there. Lost or missing person search. That's the second most popular thing. We have a lot of parks in Dakota County where people go for walks. They ride horses. They do things. If someone goes missing, that's the next most popular thing we do. Suspect search is probably the third most popular. We do that after someone would run from a stolen car, and run into the cornfield. We'd be able to bring the drone in and take a look to see if we could find that. And then the last thing would be tactical deployment on a SWAT scenario where someone is holding someone hostage or is barricaded in a building. We would have the high ground. Those of you who have been in the military understand how important it is to get the high ground so that someone can't get hurt. That's there on the scene.
Sheriff Leslie, if you could wrap up your comments, that would be helpful. Thank you.
I think the most important thing is we review every use of drones in the county with a Citizens Advisory Council. Every time we use a drone, we present that information to them, and then they make sure that it's held against policy to make sure that we're doing the things the community expects us to do and that we're in line with policy. So I would like to have next Mr. Terry Sieben, who's on the Sheriff's Citizens Advisory Council, speak to that issue.
That would be great. We have questions, but let's get to the other two testifiers, and we'll come back to those.
Okay, because I do have a question for the Sheriff.
Sure, that sounds good. Thank you. Mr. Sieben, welcome. Please introduce yourself, and if you could keep your comments to about 2 minutes or less, that would be helpful. Thank you,
Madam Chair and members. My name is Terry Sieben. I'm a resident of Hastings, Minnesota. As the Sheriff indicated, I'm a member of his Citizens Advisory Council. I've been a member for approximately a year, and my background, I'm a retired military officer, got military police and civilian police personnel director background, things like that. My scope of my testimony and comments are basically just to paint the picture of what we do as the Citizens Advisory Council, as the sheriff indicated. Maybe if you could indulge me for a second, I'll read our mission statement. The Dakota County Sheriff's Advisory Council is comprised of a diverse group of residents from communities within the county. The council routinely meets to act as a resource to the Dakota County Sheriff on policies and issues that will provide a positive impact on the safety and quality of life for Dakota County residents. I'll skip to the bottom of some of our member responsibilities. One of them is to provide helpful community feedback to the sheriff, sheriff's office, and to act as a public ambassador in response to community questions or concerns. I brought with me an example, one of the agendas that we have, and item number three on the agenda is review of recent drone deployments. So we meet usually quarterly, maybe a little more than that, and always any deployments that are done between meetings of the drones that the county has, we get all of the basic information on it. We discuss it internally, ask the sheriff questions or anything like that. And then also I brought with me a copy of our meeting minutes. And one of the examples it has in there, a spot in there of the review of the recent drone deployments. So it's covered in there. And from what I understand, these are all public record. And the sheriff is just looking for us to be able to give him feedback, insight, things like that. So whether it was the policy when it was written that the county has a unmanned aerial system operations policy that they have a document, and then they also have a written unmanned aircraft unit standard operating procedure. So they have very defined documents that would guide the eight total pilots and the operators and the three aircraft that they have.
All right. Thank you so much, Mr. Stephen, and thanks for your participation in that Citizens Advisory Council,
too. Thank you, ma'am.
And then, Superintendent, if you wanted to come down, please. Go right ahead. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Drew Evans. I'm the superintendent at the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. I'll keep my comments brief in interest of your time. We would echo some of the same concerns that the sheriff's office has held. I should note that the Department of Public Safety currently does not own or operate any UAVs in our flight section at the State Patrol or with any of our agencies. However, we do see the value of them and have been examining the use of them in our criminal investigations as we operate across Minnesota. The one concern that I want to highlight in particular for this committee is the change in the legal standard for operation of these UAVs over public properties. And for example, if any of you were like me, were fairly frustrated with your drive in this morning with the roads, and imagine a crash occurring on one of those freeways. Under this language, for the State Patrol to operate an unmanned aerial vehicle and that to take pictures of that crash scene, they would be required to go get a court order in that situation to document that scene in that situation. The bill does address in several areas reporting that would be required of us. So if the concern is creating sunlight on the use of these vehicles across Minnesota and in the operations, we would know when and where they would be used. But this would be changing the legal standard that we currently operate under for any of our law enforcement operations and public property across the state of Minnesota by requiring that additional legal hurdle in that situation. There's some other minor concerns that I've spoken with the ACLU about. I think there's ways to work through some of those, but that's our general concern, is the use of these over public properties in particular.
All right, great. Thank you. Questions from members, I believe. Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, got a few couple questions and a couple comments. First of all, for the sheriff, Sheriff Leslie, you mentioned some concerns that you had with this bill, and one of the issues where you say you use it is that we have the spring flooding coming up, and we're probably going to have some, with the amount of snow we have this year, and it sounds like more this weekend, we might have some issues with severe flooding. Now, I believe that, if I remember correctly, there is a couple dams in Dakota County. And if you're going to, because of the flooding, bring the UAV up, take some pictures of that dam, because you want to compare it 24, 48, 72 hours down the road to what it was, just to make sure that dam is being safe. With this destruction of anything within 24 hours, would that hinder you in making the situation to try and decide whether a situation around that dam is safe or not?
Chair.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson. Yeah, it would actually be difficult for us to get that reporting done immediately like that. And as you well stated, the flood situations change rapidly, and we want to be right on top of that. So that would be kind of unwieldy, I would imagine, 24 hours. Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
And also, we had a short discussion while this meeting was going on. One thing we have, most law, and I believe every law enforcement does this with their body cam video and their squad camera video. When somebody wants to look something up, it's in a system where you have to put in the case number and justification of why you're looking this looking at this video. I'm just wondering, just to make everybody so there is an audit trail, would it be difficult to set that same type of system up for the audio cam or the UAV video to put it in that same system?
Sure.
Madam Chair, members, the circumstance right now is if it was done via a criminal investigation, it would fall under the criminal investigation data practices rules. So once the criminal investigation was over, it would become public. While the investigation is ongoing, it's private, but it would be held in that retention schedule as a criminal investigation. If you wanted us to capture the search for a missing child, for example, we sure could do that. We currently do not hold on to that information. But that certainly could be captured as well.
Representative Johnson.
And one last issue. You mentioned the cost of helicopters to come up to photograph a crash scene. It's $800 plus to $1,000 an hour to get that helicopter up. The crash scene video from above is, in a serious crash, is very vital. Vital to actually try to figure out what happened in the crash. I've worked a number of them myself. Now, where I'm at, where I live, it's 50 miles north here from the time you call, the time the pilots get to the helicopter, load up. You're looking at 2.5 to 3 hours. So that's up to $3,000 to get a helicopter up just one way to take that photograph of that crash scene. That's expensive. You start figuring out the cost. Where by the time you get the UAV up and down at $20 an hour, you've probably spent $2. But that information is very, very vital. So this is a huge cost saving. As far as I've actually been involved in search for people in rural areas, there's places you can't see 3 feet on either side of you. Where if looking down above, that drone or the UAV is very vital to seeing people, finding these, especially these lost kids, because they do like to hide. It's a very valuable tool. But I want to also thank Representative Lesh for bringing this forward. I was in the process going to have mine, bill that I've had, rejacketed to get things started for next year, because I didn't think we were going to be doing it this year. There's a lot of things from my bill are in here, and I appreciate that. But with the data retention classification and the shortness of the quickness of the destruction, I do have some concerns. And just one last question for Representative Lesh. I know I was looking through here. I was trying to see. At one time, one of these versions of these UAV bill had in it that if the drone captures something outside the target area of the warrant or runs across a person, that area has to be blacked out. I'm concerned that might still be in this bill.
Chair Lesh.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair and Chair Johnson, can you rephrase that? You were concerned that what has to be blacked out?
If, Madam Chair, Representative, if they're doing a warrant or a particular to a search warrant or a, and the video of the drone is filming, and it goes off the area to turn around and come back or capture something that's not on the warrant, or off the property of the warrant, that information would have to be deleted, and there'd be gaps in the actual video. I'm just wondering if that is still in the bill or not.
Madam Chair and Chair Johnson, that is not expressly in the bill. I think what you're thinking of is how that data may be used. So for example, data outside the boundaries of a warrant is excluded, and that warrant could be invalidated if data is used in evidence collection that is outside the parameters of the warrant. That's the U.S. v. Jones problem from 2015 or whatever that case was. So that would be more an evidentiary question. With respect to the data classification, we don't make that requirement in the law. But of course, if the purpose of the data collection is not criminal, is not used for the purposes of establishing like criminal investigation or something, well, then it's just, you know, no, don't do that, I think. I mean, it could be, because of the way this is characterized, there may be a scenario where it could be a violation of the Data Practices Act, but that's only insofar as what is excluded or included in a data request. But we classified this as investigatory data. We did not demark lines between private and non-private, and you get into that problem when you're, you know, with the body cams, right? One walking down the aisle of a bus, and you got all these kids, and your body camera shot, and you have to fuzz out all the other kids' faces, kind of thing, which is a real pain. So no, we don't lay that out in the bill.
Representative, yes, I'm glad to hear that, because there could be some if it's used for evidentiary issues in the courts, and you start blacking out areas or shutting things down, it could create issues in court for seeing everything and giving the defense all the information.
Thank you. I just had a couple of questions. Some of the concerns that have been raised about, for example, the missing children, and wouldn't that fall under the Subdivision 3A exception?
Well, Madam Chair, I would note that, yes, we expressly provide provisions for threats to life or safety under 3A in situations of man-made or natural disasters in Subdivision 3D. And I'd also note, you know, the limitations of, you know, how these drones are used. Like I've stated before, the FAA, as far as they're concerned, everything above 50 feet in the air belongs to them. So there are, you know, which I think is a little ridiculous, but that's the FAA, and you can deal with them on that. So there are other restrictions to the broad applicability of how drones can be used anyway under federal law. But, yeah, I our intention and my expectation would be not just finding a missing kid, but a crash on the highway that's a threat to life or safety would be an exception that we drafted in there that should be permissible.
And, Chair Lesh, if there was some concern that language wouldn't necessarily cover the crash scene investigation, would you be open to adding that as an amendment? Has that been discussed at all?
It hasn't been discussed. I mean, that's our intent. You know, if there's a crash on the highway and you're looking at the situation of the crash. And now, keep in mind, this goes into the testimonial nature of evidence, too, right? If the evidence you're collecting is testimonial, in other words, the intent to build a case, that's a different situation than if your professed reason for putting up a drone or collecting evidence is for public safety. If it's for public safety and you're not intending to prosecute for that someone, you know, it is what it is. But if you're putting up the drone to collect evidence on who else could be involved and is there a vehicle leaving the scene or something, well, that's an entirely different reason for what's been professed as the reason for the data collection. But yes, if it's for the public safety piece, then, you know, I don't think that's what we're trying to exclude.
Okay, thank you. Let's see, we've got Representative Lucero.
Well, Madam Chair, that line of questioning just got at what I was getting, or what my intent of the question was. Much of the testimony I've heard is those exigent circumstances on property or life. And I don't think that was the intent of the bill, but you just covered that, so I appreciate it.
All right. Representative Herr.
And actually, that was my question, too, but I do want to add one more thing, though. I do notice that in Section D on page 220, it talks about how natural or man-made disaster and potential loss of life or property in that. But I'm curious in 3 why we wouldn't include property within that as well, because, you know, if my roof collapsed because a big tree fell on it, it's not a disaster, but, you know, if I have a gas line in that house and there could be an issue, and the police officer wants to use a drone for that, I think that that's loss of property, right? And so I guess I'm just curious why one says life and property, and then the other one just says, you know, life involves being likely to life or safety of a person. I'm wondering if property could be inserted in there as well.
Well, I think, I guess what I would say is, Madam Chair and Representative Herr, yes, if a tree falls on your house, I mean, that's a pending potential natural gas disaster or, you know, that's our intent. I don't know if we need to include property in that or not, but we'll consider it and take a look at that if that situation is concerned about.
So I'm just curious, the consistency of the two, but the only thing I was thinking of. But thank you.
Thank you.
Good answer.
And Representative Grassl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And question for Mr. Chair. Looking at line 2-1 through 2-8, and having done a lot of creeps and surveillance and using the open fields doctrine, I take my tools out into the field with me, binoculars, trail cams, whatever. Why would I have to get special permission to take this equipment with me to gather the intelligence I need to build this case? I don't need anything to use my binoculars or a spotting scope, which I can, from the allowable areas, I can look into wherever I want to see what is going on. I'm looking at this as this is another tool to keep both law enforcement and the suspected activity both safe, to where I can take a look from here using the same parameters as I do as an officer. I mean, there's been plenty of times where I've creeped right up to the edge of the curtilage and outsmarted their canines and such, to where I could gather the intel and then back out. What is the difference? You know, I don't want to impede what officers need as far as tools to make sure that criminal activity is stopped. So does this language interfere or impede open fields doctrine?
Well,
right,
Madam Chair and Representative Grassl, I can't speak directly to the open fields doctrine because I don't know what that is. But if you are talking about basic, like, Fourth Amendment search and seizure, right to privacy, by open fields, you mean, you know, open and apparent. You know, when someone's looking through the curtains, if you leave the curtains open, you don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy what's there. That's still on the table, and that's available. I think the reason for this bill and the regulation of this is a new technology that vastly expands the surveillability of the public who may or may not be involved in any criminal activity. And so we end up with an effect that, and I will say this, I don't think I'm necessarily concerned about any of our law enforcement officers who are either testifying here today or even aren't testifying here today. I think my best guess is they probably have pretty appropriate, they've risen to the point where they are either getting elected sheriff or getting appointed chief or something. They've risen to that position through a society that has certain expectations of respect for personal privacy of people that aren't necessarily doing things wrong. But when we're drafting these bills, we're drafting them because we see the specter of a much broader applicability under a situation where things may be different. You can think about the Public Safety Commission in Minnesota during World War I, for example, where we did not have that technology, but where people's personal rights were grossly violated on a regular basis because of that specter of war. People change from grasshoppers into locusts when they're scared. And when they're scared, and when a society is scared, they start acting in ways that violate the rights that we hold dear, which is why we want to place these parameters on the broader use of this technology, so that three generations from now, maybe,
If that situation does arise again, there are laws in place that we drafted here, just like the founders did, you know, 200 and whatever years ago, to make sure that we weren't overstepping those boundaries like they do routinely in Ukraine or in Russia or in some of those other countries that I've been to where we don't have these cultures that our chiefs and our sheriffs have grown up in. So that's really the reason for it.
Representative Grossel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chair Lesh. Would you be willing to just take a close look at those areas that I mentioned? Because this is, with open fields, I can go, if there's suspicion of criminal activity, that I can go onto this private property to cross it, staying outside of the curtilage, to do an assessment, to investigate, and then to, if there's nothing going on, you get out of there. But if there is something going on, you've got to be able to use your tools there. Would you be willing to look at that just to make sure that that is not going to interfere with the sheriff's deputies, the BCA, or anyone to be able to do the investigation properly using all the tools that they can to keep both suspect and law enforcement safe?
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Grossel, I would think so. I think I'd probably have to read up a little bit more on the open fields doctrine and some of the law enforcement practices maybe in the more rural areas to determine so I know exactly what we're talking about. But my initial answer is I think so.
Okay. Thank you.
Great. And just members, do you know what the plan is? I think what we'll do is we'll open it up for anybody else from the audience, try to take a vote on this bill, and then we'll just reserve the other two bills for that were on our agenda for today for tomorrow. I apologize to any testifiers that were here for those other bills.
Can we maybe, Madam Chair, could we ask if there's anyone here from like 50 miles or more away that have come to testify that are maybe not, it's not part of their job to be here, but they're here solely and exclusively as a citizen to be heard on some of these bills and we don't make them come back tomorrow?
Sure. Can we finish up this bill first?
Sure.
And then we can do that? So is there anybody in the audience that wishes to testify on this bill? Okay. Any more discussion from members? Any final words, Chair Lesh?
No, Madam Chair. I ask for your support.
All right. So Chair Lesh renews his motion that House File 1236 be recommended to be re-referred to the Public Safety Committee. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. The motion prevails. House File 1236 is recommended to be re-referred to the Public Safety Committee. And then with that, we did have those two other bills on our agenda for today. And is there anyone in the audience who, let's see, which ones are we have? From either House File 1196 or House File 1197, excuse me, that came some distance to be here today? Would not be able to potentially come back tomorrow. Okay, I'm not seeing anybody, so I really appreciate everybody being here today. Thank you so much. And with that, the meeting is adjourned.